You're listening to The Leonard LoPage Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Globalization has led a number of things that have traditionally been done in this country to be moved overseas, textile, manufacture, call centers, even recycling. All of this has received a lot of attention from our politicians and in the media. But drug testing has also been sent abroad, and that has been largely overlooked. Today, pharmaceutical companies are conducting hundreds of clinical trials around the world, often in impoverished countries and with little to no oversight. The phenomenon is chronicled in an article in the January issue of Vanity Fair called Deadly Medicine. I'm very pleased to welcome both of its authors, Donald Bartlett and James Steele, back to our program today. Hello.
Nice to be with you, Leonard.
Good to be back.
You compare the modern world of drug research, especially overseas, to agribusiness. In what ways are they similar? Which mainly, one are you going to start?
It mainly has to do with, in some ways, how primitive the testing is overseas. If you think about, I mean, most people think of clinical trials as doctors, nurses, highly specialized folks in medicine. And in fact, that is the way it went for many years in this country, but abroad.
Usually in universities or in hospitals.
Associated with universities and hospitals, things of that sort. But one of the things that happened as part of this globalization movement is the privatization of that process. You now have profit-making companies that are out there setting up these trials abroad, finding locals to do that work, and basically to draw the blood, to take the urine samples, to do all of those things that you do over there. But they're basically hired hands. They're not, in many cases, medical professionals.
We're talking about independent contractors.
Independent contracts, exactly.
Absolutely.
Well, between 1990 and 2008, the number of drug trials conducted overseas has increased by over 2,000%. So we're talking about an exploding field, aren't we?
It absolutely is. You've gone from about 200 and fewer than 300 trials to almost 7,000.
And are all the major pharmaceutical companies doing
it? Absolutely.
How reliant is the drug industry these days on independent contractors? I mean, we're still seeing tests being done in universities and American
yes.
hospitals. Does it matter? Is it because of the nature of the thing that's being tested that they decide whether to send it overseas or keep it here?
A couple of things I think have led to this movement abroad. Probably one of the most significant ones is, frankly, it's just cheaper. And the FDA doesn't exactly have a great record of oversight in this country, regulation. But now there's even less regulation abroad because the whole process of looking at people, what's going on over there, much more complex, much more expensive. So the irony here is the FDA, to do this would require much more money, but it's cheaper for the drug companies to do this. So it's sort of a catch-22 thing for the American consumer in that sense.
But what about the governments of these countries? Do they really want their citizens to be guinea pigs for American pharmaceutical companies?
I think there's too much money there.
They like the idea that all this money is coming into their economies?
Absolutely.
And what you also see happening is that this is a financial incentive for many health professionals in those countries or folks associated with it, because here you have a doctor in some of these places signing up people for clinical trials. They may make more on that than they make in the rest of their practice.
Because they're paid by these independent contractors?
They're paid by the independent contractors who in turn get money from the pharmaceutical companies.
And you write that the independent contractors, quote, devise the rules for clinical trials, conduct the trials themselves, prepare reports on the results, ghostwrite technical articles for medical journals, and create promotional campaigns. Sounds to me like the pharmaceutical company doesn't have to do much of anything here.
No, that's exactly right. The contractors really do everything. This has really changed in the last few years. I mean, this whole process started back in the 1990s. But in the last few years, the reach of the contract research organization has really expanded.
But it also sounds to me like it would create potential for lots of conflict of interest.
Well, that's the nature of the business. You better believe
Because if a drug trial is a success, well, I'm the same company that is going to write all the articles about it and then prepare the promotional material.
And if the drug trial is a failure, do you think the drug company is going to hire me again?
I mean, but sometimes drugs are just not efficacious.
Yeah, you would think so.
That does happen. But that's the unknown about this whole process. If there's a financial incentive by those contractors to make sure they're going to deliver favorable results to the drug companies. I mean, the drug companies themselves have been criticized many times over the way they use some of the results they get. So if you have yet another layer in there of somebody supplying them even more favorable things, let's say, then it really raises all kinds of questions about the efficacy of these tests.
And you can look at almost any drug that was approved this decade, which subsequently got a black box warning, the most serious warning there is, that often translates into deaths. They began overseas.
We're talking about Celebrex and
Celebrex, right. Vioxx, you name it, any virtually any drug.
Wasn't Keytec the same situation? So
now, what countries are we talking about?
You mean abroad? You're talking basically almost. You're talking about countries in Asia. You're talking about countries in the former Soviet Republic, Kazakhstan. You're talking about countries in Asia. I mean, the ones that are really going to be
Africa,
the leaders. Some in Africa. The ones that are really going to be the leaders, though, and you can see this happening now, are really China and India. Because one of the things that amazed us is part of this research. I mean, everybody knows India has many English-speaking doctors. In fact, they have more English-speaking doctors than we have English-speaking doctors. But what amazed us, there are more English-speaking doctors, or more people are speaking English in China than in this country now. And that has crept up very rapidly. But it's part of their policy toward teaching English becoming the international language. But this is going to have tremendous ramifications for the clinical trials because the Chinese and the Indians are really going after this business.
For what reason? I mean, to help out their doctors I'm assuming that the people who are engaging in these trials are poor people. They're the ones who are being signed up. Are they being paid as well?
In many cases, yes. In this country, the person taking part in the trial really has got to sign off on it. They've got to agree to all the potential problems that could occur. Over there, quite often, and it doesn't matter where the country is, they signify their agreement to what they're doing with marking an X on a piece of paper or putting their thumbprint on it. There is a general feeling among many, because when you have a clinical trial, half the population is getting a placebo and the other half's getting the real drug. The people getting the placebo often do not understand that. They think because the person in the white coat giving them the pill that they are getting medicine. This goes on. I mean, it's just...
So there's just tremendous ethical issues involved there. I mean, at least in this country, most people can certainly read and write when they're signing these, and when this is explained to them, maybe perhaps some of them don't fully understand everything. But abroad in some of these countries, there's just a lot of evidence that people have no idea what they're getting into.
And then the other thing is there's no oversight. People think, gee, FDA approved. That thing has, that certification has no meaning whatsoever anymore, because they really do not look. One of our favorites, this didn't even make the piece, was a doctor up in Massachusetts, Scott Rubin, who was a really prominent anesthesiologist. And he was exploring new ways to manage pain for people who underwent hip replacements or knee replacements. He was well-respected. He wrote, he wanted to get away from opiates and switch to Pfizer's drugs and Merck's. And he received money from both companies for his clinical trials. And his trials all showed that these drugs were superior to the opiates. They really worked much better. And he wrote dozens of articles for all the leading medical journals in this country. Most peer-reviewed, meaning they had undergone scrutiny by fellow practitioners. Not one of them was legitimate. He had made everything up. There were no patients in the trials. they were all carved out of fiction.
And you're saying this was done in this country.
And this was
done. We can only imagine what's happening somewhere else.
Exactly.
My guests are contributing editors to Vanity Fair, Donald Bartlett and James Steele, and they have co-authored an article called Deadly Medicine for the January issue of that magazine. Well, clinical trials here usually involve people who have some kind of a problem, an illness or a pain that has to be dealt with. Is the same true there? Or if you're testing out a diabetes drug, are people who have diabetes being enlisted for the trials?
Sure. Now, there's a...
I guess we can be grateful for little things.
There is one statistic that just blew us away, and that is you don't see it often, and that is that half of all drugs do not work. So if you have 100 people in a trial, 50 of them will see no benefit whatsoever. Some of them will be harmed, some in varying degrees. But 50 out of the 100 will see zero benefit from the medicine. And this is typical. It ranges depending upon the condition. Cancer, it's like 1 in 4 receive some benefit. Others are higher. 80% receive a benefit, but on average, 50% receive no benefit whatsoever.
That's despite the placebo effect?
Yes.
So if we throw in the placebo effect, then we would say that the drug is even less effective.
Exactly.
And the FDA must know this. What is the FDA doing here? I'm getting the sense that FDA certification has no meaning anymore.
I think you put your finger on it. In fact, the FDA has never always had the greatest record in terms of this oversight. But the erosion of the agency, the way it's been slowly sort of dumbed down for various reasons over the last 10 to 20 years is a significant thing. It's interesting, you go into some blogs out there in the blogosphere, former FDA people who've been there who talk about things, and they say a lot of the people in the agency are actually quite concerned about things, but there's just been a conscious effort to downplay many of these problems.
By whom? Is there pressure? You're saying 20 years, that means both the Clinton and the Bush administration, and we're still talking about a situation now with the Obama administration.
This goes beyond parties.
And it certainly has gotten much worse in the last 10 years or so. There's no doubt about that, but it does predate that.
But pressure from the pharmaceutical companies?
Pharmaceutical companies. I mean, they have tremendous influence in that agency. I mean, all kinds of drugs from time to time are pulled off shelves in other countries, Europe. You've got a situation that's crazy when the Saudi Arabian drug industry or drug agency pulls a drug off the shelf that's allowed to stay on the shelves in this country.
Which is that?
Avandia, I believe, was one, which has been the subject of all kinds of litigation. But, I mean, that tells you something about just how that works. Now, and here's why this is happening. People think of lobbying and the influence of these companies in Washington, and this is really worth mentioning. People think of influence campaign contributions. And while that is true, the big issue in Washington is the lobbying. I mean, this industry, it's about $200 million a year they spend lobbying, far more than they spend on campaign contributions. And the lobbying isn't Congress, necessarily. It's that agency and all various branches of that. That's where the most significant lobbying goes on.
But aren't these drugs also tested by the European Union? So does that have any impact if it's tested? Do they just simply trust the same clinical trials that the FDA is accepting?
That's a good
I don't know.
I honestly don't know.
I think that in some cases drugs are banned in Europe and in Saudi Arabia.
I think,
but not here.
I think,
and vice versa.
I think when adverse incidents began occurring in Europe and in other places around the world, then those agencies took a much more proactive position and they began looking at these things in more detail. But so many of these drugs are really coming out of largely. Heavily U.S.-based companies. I mean, Avandia is Glaxo, which is, of course, British and American. But many of these stem from a lot of the trials that certainly initiate here.
Has any of this been addressed by the new health care bill?
No.
No.
And it won't be. there literally is too much money here. And The other thing, to give the FDA a little easing, in the 1990s, there was a terrific push by Congress to ease up on the FDA. And as a result, the FDA really became, they kind of almost changed its mission to work with the drug companies to get their product to market rather than to oversee them.
That's really a good point, because a lot of that emphasis was on the theory that there are all of these excellent drugs out there that can solve all kinds of problems, and somehow the FDA, because of its regulatory ineptness, is not approving them.
This was that part of that free market, let everything go and everything will be just...
The market corrects itself.
Exactly.
And it does. People die. That's the only difference.
My guests are Donald L. Bartlett and James B. Steele, who have written an article, a startling article, for the January issue of Vanity Fair called Deadly Medicine, subtitled Prescription Drugs for Allergies, Arthritis, Diabetes, and Other Ailments Kill Some 200,000 Americans Every Year. Will that number go up now that most clinical trials are conducted overseas on sick Russians, homeless Poles, and slum-dwelling Chinese in places where regulation is virtually non-existent, the FDA doesn't reach, and mistakes can end up in paupers' graves? Stay with us. We are back with Donald Bartlett and James Steele, the contributing editors to Vanity Fair. Their article, Deadly Medicine, appears in the January issue of that magazine. To some degree, doesn't this also come out of the feeling some years back, especially when HIV/AIDS entered the public consciousness, that the rules were too strict and that people were not being given drugs that might keep them alive because we had to go through this very rigid process?
That's kind of – I think you're absolutely right. That did happen, and that's the irony of this situation. On the one hand, perhaps some of those promising things are not introduced into the market. At the same time, some of the tests and the approval procedure for a number of other drugs is perhaps streamlined and rushed through. And later, you find out that these tests have all kinds of flaws in them, that there's been selective viewing of the evidence, and that some of those drugs, if they were going to be marketed, should at least have had a much stronger warning than they did.
The other aspect of this is, you know, you can look at AIDS and make that case. But you look at a psychic drug like Seroquel. Once it gets approved for whatever, and originally I think it was solely for schizophrenia and then was gradually expanded, the off-market prescription, off-label prescriptions – dwarf everything else. So now you have a drug with disastrous side effects being given to six-year-olds. And that's the downside of not having tight regulation.
And I'm glad you brought up the six-year-olds, because a lot of this testing is being done on children in ways that would not be allowed in this country.
Exactly. I mean, there's the one case we talk about in Argentina of a drug there, Synflorix, if I'm not mistaken.
Right.
And a number of babies died from those tests. And the parents clearly, in most cases, did not know who that was. The company was fined in Argentina. That one hasn't worked its way into the U.S., but it certainly there were probably hopes that it would have. But again, you have a case where the control group, the one getting this experiment, really has no idea that they're sort of guinea pigs for that process.
In Argentina, that case, the children were being given an experimental vaccine to compete with an existing vaccine. Why even develop a new vaccine for something that already has a cure?
Money. Money dominates everything that goes on in this industry. And if you have any doubt about that, listen to CNBC someday during the morning hours. That's all they talk about. Are the drug companies and their future prospects, how much money can be made? If you went back 30 years in this country and you read a newspaper story on a drug development, you may or may not see the potential revenue, but I guarantee you it's not in the second paragraph as it is today.
Now the drug companies, of course, do a lot of advertising on CNBC and everywhere else.
That's exactly right.
You can't watch 60 Minutes without seeing an ad every commercial break, at least one ad for some drug or another.
Absolutely. They just dominate the airways in every conceivable way.
Now, I'm assuming those drugs are as good or as dangerous as all of those. The announcer says, do not take this if you have high blood pressure, if you are breathing. If you live on Earth.
Well, what's so interesting about this advertising is that this was basically prohibited in most of our history. And in fact, many other countries around the world prohibit this kind of advertising. You can't do this in Canada, for example. And it was only a change in regulations, I believe, in 97, 98, yeah. I think it was, through the FDA that they allowed. Prior to that, you had to have a long, extremely wordy disclaimer, which was impossible for television and radio advertising. So it just made it impossible. They eliminated that provision, and the result of that was you have this flood of television advertising. You go back and look at the original stories where that was permitted, and this was seen as a plus for consumers.
That now, they say it's educational.
Educational, mm-hmm. Exactly. Yes. This will now give consumers more options, and they can educate themselves about what's necessary.
But basically what happens is consumers go to the doctors and say, I have this condition that has been given a new name, right. By the way, in
right.
A commercial. And give me the drug.
And
why would the doctor say no unless the doctor thought it was going to kill you?
Absolutely. I saw it last night on television, Doc. I want this. And they told me to ask you about it. So here I am.
In the case of Argentina or some of the other cases, because there have been any number of instances where people have been harmed, killed often, has anyone been held responsible for example, the deaths in Argentina?
No.
There was a fine in Argentina, yeah. If I'm not mistaken, but beyond that, to our knowledge, nothing.
My guests are Donald Bartlett and James Steele, the contributing editors of Vanity Fair, who have given us an article called Deadly Medicine. It's in the January issue of their magazine. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. The contract research industry makes over $20 billion in revenue annually. Who owns these companies?
They're basically independent. They're Quintiles, the largest, is owned in part by a hedge fund. I mean, these are not – the ownership is not people – does not consist of people looking to improve the health of the population. They're looking to make money.
In 2008 alone, 80% of applications submitted to the FDA for new drugs contain data from foreign clinical trials. How many of them wind up getting approved? Or does the FDA say at least, well, okay, this is interesting, but you have to do a few clinical trials in the United States as well?
No.
It's a very complex process, and it's one of the part of our education of this. It astonished us because in some ways, and sometimes even after a drug is approved, clinical trials continue to look at other ways that perhaps it might be used or to follow up, and that's very, very complex process. So, and in fact, some of these trials contain data from the U.S. as well as other places abroad, and it's sometimes very hard to separate that out. The Inspector General of Health and Human Services, which oversees health matters, FDA and other agencies, did a very exhaustive study this last year where a number of these statistics emerge. And the reason they did this study is because when they looked to FDA, and the National Institutes of Health, which also keeps a lot of information on clinical trials, they found out there was no really solid data on how many of these tests are going on, where they're going on, how effective they are. So here you have all of this happening, and the agencies responsible for it don't even know where these things are occurring in many cases.
And once the FDA label is put on it, no one really looks to see what's happening. Whatever rolls in. There's nobody out looking to see whether the side effects are actually killing a lot of people.
What about the fact that in many countries people have different diets, they have different exercise regimens, they are subject to other kinds of illnesses? Would a drug that is meant to be to treat hypertension be as effective with somebody who has malaria?
you've actually hit the nail on the head as far as we're concerned, because even if these trials were conducted with total, let's say, accuracy and the highest of standards, that raises another whole issue, because different parts of the world, there are environmental factors, there's ethnic backgrounds of people. The Japanese for years have been very, if I'm not mistaken, been very skittish about the idea of certain kinds of trials being conducted there, because they felt they didn't want any of that information commingled with other folks, other countries, and so forth. But it raises very, very valid issues, and there are a lot of researchers who are writing about this. They're saying this is one of those issues that we need to address as more and more of these trials go abroad.
You also write about something the drug industry calls rescue countries. What are they?
When they need a favorable result, basically.
So in 2004, the FDA certified Ketek as safe, and that decision was based largely on information collected from rescue countries?
Yeah, that was...
And that's turned out to be disastrous.
Yes, absolute disaster.
But why was it even needed? Because the results weren't working well for them in other countries?
The other trials weren't producing the results that were needed.
Well, here you had a drug in this country in one of the largest trials down in Alabama. The doctor running the trial, like the Massachusetts anesthetist we mentioned, had fabricated the people taking part in it. And so much of the data was phony. And then you had another major, the third largest trial was run by a coke addict. And then on the day the data was submitted to the FDA, was arrested because he was holding his wife at gunpoint. I mean, if it wasn't so serious, it would be slapstick humor. But it is deadly serious.
And we allow them to pick and choose the results that...
That's exactly right. Right. You don't like the results you have because it's not working so well with these six enrolled people in Alabama. Let's go with six people in Tunisia and see if it works a little better.
But there's another side to this I've always wondered about. So the drug is put out on the market and it turns out to be a total disaster. We discover after the fact whatever the test results were, that it is, the side effects are killing people, or it's killing people. There's a class action suit, and the pharmaceutical company has to come up with billions of dollars to pay off people. Is that still cost effective for
them?
Yes.
Yes,
that's what is amazing. Yes. I mean, look at the lawsuits now on Avandi alone are just amazing, and many of those are still working their way through the system. And that's going to cost the company billions of dollars probably.
I think the pharmaceutical industry just factors in that cost when it's making its estimates.
Every once in a while that's just going to happen. That's the price of business.
Certain drugs for adults are also increasingly being prescribed to children and adolescents. And you note that between 1999 and 2007, the use of antipsychotic medications on children between the ages of 2 and 5 has doubled. Why are we giving antipsychotic medication to toddlers?
That's a very good question.
Can you even find out whether a toddler is psychotic?
Well, I think there's a real school of thought.
I mean, colic,
that
yes.
They're not, exactly.
Right.
That they're not.
This kid's crying too much.
We'll take care of him.
Yeah. But it's very sad because increasingly kids are being medicated. And you see this in the schools with autism. And the other thing is that's going on that you do not know is when a drug is given to someone, what the result is going to be, not now, but 10 years from now. We wrote about this in our critical condition book, DES, a synthetic estrogen, which was widely prescribed in the 50s and 40s and 50s. And it turned out that the daughters of the women who took that drug developed cancer, and nobody recognized it for a long time. So the drug actually was killing people in a future generation.
Is it ironic that if the drug is a success, that it'll be a lot less expensive to the people in the countries that it was tested in than it will in this country? Well, I mean, you know, I needed an eye drop in Italy. Mm-hmm. A prescription eye drop here. I went into a pharmacy in Italy, didn't need a prescription. They gave it to me for what my pharmacy says is a lot less than he has to pay, for it on the wholesale rate.
Well, this gets back to an issue we've actually written about a little bit in the past, which is, we pay the highest prices for pharmaceuticals and drugs in this country anywhere in the world. And it's and every time there's an effort made to try to control those prices, usually it's knocked down. There's a famous one back when they tried to get – the Veterans Administration is one of the largest purchasers of pharmaceuticals that you'll find. And they wanted to put out certain bids for certain drugs that they would dispense to people in the VA system. And that was knocked down at Congress because the companies very vigorously lobbied against that.
So Congress is at fault for
Congress is
of
at fault.
Problem.
That's part of the lobbying. I mean, you go anywhere in the world almost, and drugs are costing less because those governments have decided that this has to do with public health, and they should be more available if people need them.
Just one other thing. Our prisons are filled with people who take illegal drugs, but you note that overall deaths from FDA-approved prescription drugs dwarf the number of people who die from street drugs like cocaine and heroin.
Right. That's exactly right. That's not even close.
So should we be so are we misdirecting the war on drugs after the FDA?
That's a really good point.
We probably, for two different reasons, are misdirecting that.
But you raise it. You emphasize that point. This is really Congress. I mean, the FDA is doing it, but the FDA is doing exactly what Congress wants.
And that's where it gets back to what we were talking about, the money. There's just so much money, and they don't want to stop that flow.
And unfortunately, I can't ask you, what can we do about this? Because the answer doesn't seem to be vote for somebody else. Whoever you vote for seems to be a problem.
It does not matter.
Thank you both so much for being with us, Donald L. Barlett and James B. Steele, who are both contributing editors to Vanity Fair. Their article, Deadly Medicine, is in the January issue. It's an eye-opener. Thank you so much for talking about it with us.
Great to be with you, Leonard.